I'm Sarah Kelleher, and this is Psych in the City, a podcast about sexuality, relationships, and health. One psychotherapist, me, gives you the sex and psych education you didn't get in social work school, or most likely anywhere. Hello, and welcome back to Psych in the City. Today, I'm speaking to Joan Price. Joan Price calls herself an advocate for ageless sexuality. She has been called other things by the media, senior sexpert, the woman leading a sex revolution for seniors, and her favorite, wrinkly sex kitten. Joan is the author of 4 books about senior sex, including the award-winning Naked at Our Age, Talking Out Loud About Senior Sex, and Sex After Grief, Navigating Your Sexuality After Losing Your Beloved. An internationally popular public speaker and sex educator, Joan has been writing and speaking about senior sex since 2005. Her blog offers senior sex news, views, and sex toy reviews from a senior perspective. At age 78, Joan Price continues to talk out loud about senior sex, partnered or solo, in live and virtual presentations and webinars.
Joan, I was actually surprised that you answered and agreed to do this interview.
Well, why would that be?
Because I feel that you are very famous, at least in like the sex therapy world. I've read a few of your book. Maybe that's just because I'm in that world and I'm like, you're a known name.
Well, thank you.
I know. I was really surprised. So I'm really excited to have you on. Joan, can you tell us a little bit about, for people that don't know you, a little bit about your work, who you are, what you do, and then we'll talk about your newest book, which I'm really excited about.
Sure. I call myself an advocate for ageless sexuality. And by that, I mean, I talk out loud about senior sex. And by that, I mean that I write books and articles and give presentations and webinars all on the subject of sex and aging, which I have expanded, though, with my latest book, Sex After Grief, to include people who are grieving the loss of their beloved. And they may not be older people. Most of the people I interviewed were, but not all. And this book is really across all age groups.
Yeah, I am about halfway, 2/3 of the way through your book, and it's really amazing. And in the beginning of it, you had sort of mentioned that in your work and in your research that there are a lot of books about grief. And there are a lot of books about sex, but not really a lot of information about grief and sexuality. And why do you think that it is a less discussed topic in general when it comes to blending of the two?
Well, this is a huge problem. And this is exactly why I felt I needed to write this book, having been through grief and having been through trying to recover my sexuality when I was numb and I was distraught. And I went looking for books that addressed grief and sexuality together. I found nothing, Sarah, nothing. Maybe a paragraph here and there in a grief book that basically warned you not to make any decisions you'd regret later, and that was it. But there was nothing really that dealt in a sex positive way about sex and sexual urges and desires and fears and reluctance and all those things that go into deciding what to do when the person that you really want to go to bed with is dead.
Yeah.
And so I felt if this book doesn't exist, and I have had these experiences myself, and I have a little bit of notoriety where people will pay attention if I write this book, and I felt this was really important. So I wrote Sex After Grief, Navigating Your Sexuality After Losing Your Beloved in 2019. It has since won awards, and I'm very grateful for that and honored by that. It's a hard thing because people who are in grief don't know whether they want to even read a book about sex. Mm. And then people who are I'm asked a lot, why did you make it so narrow, navigating your sexuality after losing your beloved? How about after divorce? How about after losing a pet? How about after all these other kinds of grief? And yes, much of what I write in this book is applicable to all kinds of grief. But the point is that there is no book for this kind of grief.
This particular grief, yes, after you losing a partner.
Exactly. There is nothing about that. And so I felt we need to have this because there's a need for it.
Yeah. So I know of your work related to sex at any age, ageless sexuality. And so now this is also incorporated under your umbrella of specialty because, like, as you get older, you may lose a partner ultimately, or the person that you've been in relation with for years, or whatever that looks like.
You're pretty much guaranteed to.
Yeah.
Either you'll die first or your partner will die first. It's rare that you die in the same moment.
Totally. And why is sex and grief important to you to talk about? And why did it become important to you?
Well, we know that sex is good for us. We know that sexual pleasure, sexual release, orgasms, they're good for us. They're good for our health. They're good for our sense of well-being. But when we're in grief, everything is different. For one thing, we may think that sex means either I'm not having sex at all, no orgasms, no nothing, or I'm going to bed with a new partner and I'm not ready for that. Mm-hmm. They don't realize, first of all, that there's so much in between that. There are so many ways that you can have great sex with yourself, that you can bring your body back to life if it's numb, that you can give that to yourself, and that, yes, you may cry before, during, and after, but you will also feel better. You'll get that release. You'll get that, so maybe I can sleep tonight for the first time in 5 nights. You might get that. Mm. From a sexual release. And then also one of the big messages of the book is that when you feel like you might kind of sort of be ready for a sexual experience with a new person, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It doesn't have to be going from this person fully dressed in front of me to us ripping our clothes off and having full on sex, whatever that means for us, whether it's partner intercourse or some kind of penetrative sex or spending the night. You don't have to do all that. You can get into sex gradually, and I really recommend that. I recommend that, for example, you might say to someone that you're attracted to that maybe you've been on a couple of dates, and notice we're rushing across to dating right now. The book is a lot about what to do before dating. And if you're not ready for dating, but let's say you might think, I really want to feel a partner's hands on me, but I don't know if I'm ready for everything. But if we get started, that's what this person will expect from me. Therefore, mm-hmm. either don't start or just bite the bullet and go through with it. That's not necessarily good for us. If instead we can say to a possible new partner, I'm attracted to you. I sense some smart sparks between us. I don't know what I'm ready for sexually, but I'd love to kiss you for a while and see how that feels. Would you be willing to do that with me? In other words, learn to talk about it and learn to ask for what you want. It isn't a matter just of saying, I don't know if I'm ready for sex, so let's, if we get started, I might call a stop to it. Yes, you can say that, but wouldn't it sound better if you said, I'd really love to just kiss you for a while, and let's agree that it won't go farther than that this time. And that's then emphasizing the positive, letting us get into letting ourselves get aroused with another person without feeling that we're committed to something we might not be ready for yet.
So, yeah, let's talk about who this book is for. Like, who should read it? Who is it for?
Such a wonderful question. Thank you, Sarah. It is for people who have lost a partner and either question their sexual feelings or question their lack of sexual feelings and want to know what's normal, what's not normal, what do I expect, what can I do about it, how can I have an action plan, if I feel this, what can I do, what can I say, if I then feel this, what can I do, what can I say. Because the book is very practical and every chapter ends with an action plan.
Yes.
It is also for people who want to date someone in grief. There's a whole chapter specifically if you want to date a griever, but there's also all of it would be so important because I often talk to people who are dating people in grief and they're saying, yeah, but she has a shrine to her late husband. I don't think I can do that. Isn't that weird? It's been 10 years. And I want to let them know that nothing is weird. It may not be what they're used to, but we deal with grief differently. And here are some ways, and here's what you understand. It is also, and here's probably the reason I'm on your podcast, it's for people who work with people in grief. It is for therapists. It is for grief counselors who don't know what to do about sex. It is for sex counselors that don't know what to do about grief. It is for therapists of all kinds who maybe they've been working with someone and then that person loses a partner. And you want to keep working with that person, but you don't know if you have the tools. So the tools are in here.
It's very practical.
I also give presentations to professionals. I gave a talk just a week ago to the Society of Australian Sexologists. I did that online and I admire that organization so much. It's the major organization for sex therapists in Australia. And I was honored to be able to talk to them about this subject. And it was just a marvelous experience. And I want to do that more. So get in touch.
Yeah, it is a very practical book in that every chapter does end with sort of, hey, these are the actionable things that I've recommended. How do you emulate them for yourself? And I think that's really, really useful. Even the part where it, what to say or what to say to people who may unintentionally say just the wrong thing to someone that is grieving or that people make comments about if you're dating or not dating and what's the wrong way. And you mentioned this a lot in the book about there's sort of a perceived right way and wrong way that people should be grieving and how that's actually just not true.
Not true at all.
Yeah.
There are several ways that that's done. People, and I have a chapter on the myths that we may believe about sex and grief that are wrong and yes. also how to talk to people who throw those at you. This happened to me a lot and I hear it from just about everyone who is in grief who contacts me and that happens to me a lot. I have people who make consultation appointments with me. They say, I have a grief counselor. I have a therapist. I cannot talk to them about my sexual feelings. They judge me, they shame me. They don't mean to, but they come across that way. And I feel like I must be doing grief wrong. So there's no way to do grief wrong if you're being authentic. There are ways that we are taught grief is supposed to work that it doesn't. There are also, there's this hush-hush attitude that we can't talk about sex. A number of people who have come to my workshops have said, I went through the hospice support group after my spouse died, and sex was never brought up, and I was horny all the time, and I didn't dare bring it up. And there are people that get the opposite. They say, people say, you've been grieving long enough. When are you going to start dating? When are you going to get out there? And they're making me feel like there's something wrong with me because I'm not ready. And there's one of the major messages of my book and of my workshops is that there is no timeline that is right for everyone. And this is something even that therapists get wrong often. I'm not going to say all, but some of the things that we think we know are incorrect, or at any rate, they're not helpful. And one of those is the timeline. There is no set time when grief is over. It doesn't work that way. We go through grief, but we don't go through in a linear way. We don't start here and end here. We go in cycles. We feel it strongly. We're devastated. As I put it, I felt as if I was bicycling through peanut butter while an elephant kicked me in the chest. At its worst, that's how it felt. Bicycling through peanut butter while an elephant kicked me in the chest. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't move. I kept struggling. Everything was a struggle. Everything was a struggle. Waking up, going to sleep, remembering whether I'd taken my medications. Everything was a struggle. Trying not to cry in public, but doing it anyway. Going to Trader Joe's and reaching for an item that had been something I always bought for Robert and I accidentally put it in my shopping cart. And then I went, wait, I don't eat that. And Robert isn't here anymore, bursting into tears at Trader Joe's. Bursting into tears in the DMV because I was trying to transfer Robert's car into my name. And they said, well, you have to prove he's dead. Yes, I had the death certificate, but to say it that bluntly, I just burst into tears at DMV. And this young person who was at the window didn't know, oh dear, I'm sorry, did I say something? Well, yeah. Right. So the day-to-day, minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour process of being in grief can be that, can be what I'm describing. Or it can settle. It can seem to settle in a way where grief isn't gone, but I'm managing it. I'm teaching my line dance class in the evening. So what if I have to cry in the locker room afterwards and then cry on the way home? I taught my class for 2 hours. I did it. So grief becomes a pattern, but we don't know exactly what the pattern is. We know that sometimes it envelops us totally, and other times we can sort of put it aside. We're still wearing it, but it's not the only thing we're wearing, if that makes any sense. And we can do some things in our daily life. And then sometimes we can even find joy and we think, oh my gosh, it's so long since I laughed this hard. This really feels wonderful. Am I over grief? No, it'll come back again, but maybe not quite so strongly. I was honored to be the niece of a very well-known psychotherapist, Larry Lachan. And he died a couple of years ago at the age of 100. He and I were very close, and he lost his wife, Ida LeShan, after 58 years together. Really, and he nearly died himself from grief. He said, I used to counsel people about grief, and I realize now I didn't know an effing thing. He didn't say effing, but I'm not sure how to. I want to keep this language okay for your audience.
It's totally fine.
Okay. He said, I didn't know a fucking thing. And then later, then he was telling me, the grief is still a knife that stabs me, but it's not so sharp or so deep or so often. I thought that was really beautiful.
Yeah.
That just to understand, grief doesn't end, but it becomes over time less sharp, less deep, less often. We can manage, we can live our life. And coming back to our topic, this can include sex with another person. But there's no timeline that's right for everyone. No, there's this mythological 1 year rule.
I read about that in your book, and it's so funny because in other spaces, there is also this like, oh, wait 1 year, you know, give yourself a year.
Right.
And it's sort of arbitrary in like, why? What's a year? You know,
I don't get it really.
I understand its point in essence.
Yeah.
And also it's not just this one size fits all rule that can be applied to every sort of person.
Exactly, Sarah. That's exactly it. That maybe a 1 year rule is good when you're talking about mixing finances with someone, mm-hmm. or making a major financial change or investment or doing something that you can't undo.
Mm-hmm.
Something you can't undo. Maybe a 1 year rule is good for that because we do have grief brain. Our minds don't work properly. We are damaged.
Mm.
We are brain damaged by grief, but not permanently brain damaged. It just takes over. The brain chemicals are all askew. Mm. And so we can't expect someone in grief to function whatever normally is.
Sure.
But even if we say, it'd be a good idea not to get married in the first year, not to give your house away,
right?
Not to send money to a Nigerian prince. But there is no reason why you can't get involved with another person, why you can't have sex with another person, maybe even fall in love. I don't know. That's you. I don't have any way to know that about you. But certainly to put the 1 year rule on sex is crazy. There's no reason for it. Some people want sex right away.
Mm.
I actually know someone who was making a sex date for the evening after the funeral of his beloved husband.
What I thought was interesting too, in part of the book where it had personal stories or just where people had quotes, mm-hmm. and someone had said that, you know, my partner was ill for a long time. I've grieved for the entire time that they were sick. So after they had passed, I felt ready to move on in that sense. And I thought that was just such an interesting, I mean, makes so much sense, but just such an interesting turn of like, you can grieve even before, especially in long-term illness.
Yes.
You can grieve before someone has officially passed, you know?
That's right. And this reminds me of one example. It might be the one you're talking about, because there's more than one in the book like that. But this was a man, as you said, his wife had been ill for years and he had been the primary caregiver. Mm. And so he had grieved. They had been together 35 years and she was the love of his life, but he started grieving years ago. And with the help of his sister, who prompted him to talk to her about this before she died, the wife said, don't be a hermit. Mm. Don't be a hermit. Don't put your life on hold after I die. You've put your life on hold already. Find joy again. And after she died, the sister said, so are you going to do online dating or what? How can I help you? And he said, I don't even know what you're talking about, but I'm very lonely and very sad.
Yeah. And I liked the part, which I'd like to go over, you know, sort of some of the common misconceptions about grief and sex and partners. And this idea of, I feel that guilt came up a lot in some of the stories, and that this placed guilt that sometimes people put on survivors or people that where their partner has died of, oh, it's too soon, or you should be doing this, or it's disrespectful to do this to your partner. Like, tell me about, is that something you see a lot in your work?
I do. I see it a lot. I see it both from the griever who says, I am betraying my spouse or my partner by wanting to have sex with someone else. I shouldn't be feeling this. And sometimes if it's an older person, the grown children reinforce that. Mm. Wait, dad has only been dead 6 months and you want to date? What's the matter with you? Didn't you love him? I thought you loved him. You're betraying him. You're betraying all of us. Mm. And this is a really horrible thing to be faced. I would implore anyone who is listening to this, who may have a grieving parent in their own lives, to be kinder than that, to realize it's not about them. It's about need. It's about deprivation. Mm. It's about deep sadness, relentless sadness, where the affection of another person could help for a time. It's not going to erase anything. That grief will be there. They'll come back to it. And I can certainly speak from my own experience, and I'm very willing to. I am in a new relationship now. Well, new, it's 5 years old, but my husband died in 2008, so it seems new. And I am still in love with Robert, my dead husband. He is the love of my life, will always be. I will never feel anything else about him. But having loved that way, I can take that love with me. I can love again. I can love a new person without it in any way diminishing what I felt and still feel for the man I lost. And this is something that we need to understand about ourselves and about each other. And I want to give some advice to people who are alive. I Please. Guess it's the only way I can. It's the only way I'm guaranteed to be able to reach them. Come to think of it, that was a stupid thing to say.
Hey. No, please, yes.
And it's this. If you have a partner now, sit down with this partner and give each other your blessing to move on after one of you dies.
Mm. Why do you think that's important?
It is important because when I counsel, I'm not a therapist, but I do consultations with people. Sometimes they just need one session with someone who understands this particular arena. Mm. And one of the things they say when they're experiencing survivor's guilt or guilt about wanting to move on, and they say, I feel like I'm betraying my partner. I say, wait, if it had been you that died first, what would you want for your partner? Oh, well, that's easy. I'd want my partner to find love again. So what do you think your partner would tell you if you just said, hey, what'll I do now? What would your partner say? Sometimes, and that often helps. But what if we did this when we were alive? What if we sat down with our partner and said, I don't like to think about this, and it's really hard to talk about this, and you're going to say stop, but I don't want to stop. If I die first, I want you to know that I know you love me. And if you are able to move on to touch someone else, laugh with someone else, love someone else, be with someone else in whatever way makes sense to you, I give my permission, not that you need it, but I give it, I give my blessing. I want you happy. I want you not to put your life on hold. Yes, grieve me as you need to grieve me, but realize I can't help you with that anymore. The only help I know how to give you is to say, please find joy again. I know you love me. I know you will love me. I don't want you to put your life on hold for me.
Do you think that in one part of the book, which I'm trying to find right now, but I've lost it, do you think that it's uncomfortable for, I mean, we know that it's uncomfortable in general for the culture, you know, in the United States, we can speak to, of talking about grief and then talking about sex, and the combination of the two of them together, particularly the type of grief that people experience after a partner has died. Do you think it's more uncomfortable because we live in this, like, I don't know what it's called, but like the mono love culture of like, you love one person for the rest of your life. It's this big love and no one else. And so that is a part of like this dialogue around betrayal and guilt, and that it can sometimes happen when, what does it mean to date someone after your long-term partner or partner has died? Do you think that contributes to like this silence about wanting to date or have sex with other people? Like, yes. Do you think that's part of it? Okay.
Oh, yes. It's the sex negative culture. It's the grief avoidance culture. It's the fairy tale culture. You will find your prince charming and you will ride off into the sunset. If one of you dies, then you just throw yourself on the funeral pyre and that's it.
That's it for you. Yeah.
Yeah. But we, some of us die early. Some of us live long. And besides, it's just a myth anyway.
Yeah. It doesn't erase what we've had with another.
No, it doesn't. Now it may feel like that. And one of the things I go into a lot in the book is, what if you try to have sex with a new partner and it doesn't work? You burst into tears. You can't go through it. All these things happened to me. I did all of it in trying to find my way. I did it all. And you have to be able to say, I think I'm ready. Whoops, I found out I wasn't. Let me take a little more time. But what did I learn from this experience? It wasn't wasted. It wasn't a mistake. What did I learn from it? Was it that I'm not ready for sex with a new person after all? Is it just that there's something about this new person that wasn't right for me? Was it that I didn't know how to have the conversation right? What can I learn from this? And if we make it that positive of not just, oh no, I did it wrong, but no, that didn't work. So what did I learn from it? And what can I do differently next time? So we're always moving forward in a positive, self-accepting way.
Mm. What were some of the things you had shared this experience about how you found, I think in the book, you were having sex with a new person and you could only really reach orgasm when thinking about your husband.
Yes.
And you, I think in the book, it was like, oh, I actually found out that was very common. Were there other things within your own experience or when you were researching for the book that were actually less discussed things that many grievers that you spoke to had experienced when it came to sex, like that, for example, or that when, if a partner was maybe dying or ill, that they felt really horny, like were there things that you found that were a shared experience, but maybe people didn't know that they were a shared experience?
Yes, all of the above. Now, to take your last one, that people felt really horny and they judged themselves for that. They thought, oh, no, that I can't be feeling that. I should just be sad. I should just be desperately grieving. How can my, but our bodies are remarkably resilient. And we're not taught this. We don't know this. No one announces this in the grief support group. By the way, there will be times that your sexual arousal will break through this grief. Mm. And you can acknowledge that. And you can say, actually, that feels kind of nice. Grab your favorite vibrator. Make some time. Lock the door and see if you can give yourself pleasure. See if you can take a break from grief to give yourself pleasure. Mm. So there's that. There's the feeling of betraying the partner if I'm interested in someone else. I remember, and I put this in the book, that I was feeling numb. My body was numb. My mind was numb. I couldn't imagine sex with anyone else. I couldn't even imagine sex with myself at first because I just went numb. That's how my brain did to me. And then one night I had a dream, and in the dream I was walking with a man that I didn't actually know, a stranger, and we were walking sort of side by side, but he was a little behind me. So he had his arm around my shoulder and he was a little behind me. And we were walking in pace together and he was pressing into me. And in the dream, I felt his erection and I got really excited feeling this strange man who is partially embracing me has an erection. Oh boy. I woke up from the dream and I was aroused and I sat up in bed and I said, I'm alive.
I'm back, baby. Yeah,
exactly. it was a grief shattering experience where it felt like I had shattered grief in order for my body to tell me it still worked.
I really liked that part too, where you were saying that it came also in stages, like your process of how you had that dream and you woke up and were aroused. And then a couple of months or years later, you had partnered sex. And then a time after that, you were actually able to joyfully have partnered sex. And just this way that you spoke to, like, it's a process too. It's not like, oh, we're miserable one day and then the next day or in a few months, then we're back to having sex the exact way we were, in the exact way that we could, that there's a lot of in between and ups and downs and everywhere that happen, and that it's a process to move through, which I thought was just articulated really well.
Thank you. And you said something really magical that I hoped we would talk about, which is, at a certain point, you're supposedly ready to have sex the way you did before. Mm. It's not going to be the way you did before necessarily. That's the thing. There are many people, especially if they were in a long-term monogamous marriage, where they think that's the only kind of sex they're entitled to, is another long-term committed monogamous something. And yet that may not be the kind of relationship model that works for them at this time of their life. And that I try to get them to open their mind to that, that maybe all they ever knew was this committed monogamous relationship. They were in it for maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 years in some cases. But what might work for them now is a way to just explore their sexuality without that emotional commitment that they're not ready for because they're still grieving their mate. But maybe they're ready to see what kind of pleasure their bodies can offer them. I'm not saying go against your belief system, but so many people that get to be in their 50s, 60s, and 70s grew up without really questioning that that was the kind of relationship they were supposed to have or at least aspire to. And so they make the mistake of saying, well, I'm attracted to someone. I want to go to bed with them. So that must mean I'm in love with them. And they get into all kinds of trouble that I hope as therapists, the audience can help them not get into, to help them see, well, maybe that is what you're used to. But what is it you really want right now? And if they say, for example, I just want to feel someone's hands bringing me pleasure. Well, maybe you don't have to wait for your next true love. Maybe you can negotiate that kind of relationship for a while.
Yeah, maybe this person doesn't have to be your next long-term partner.
Right.
It can just be a beautiful moment of exploration or all the other ways it could be. It doesn't have to be, okay, this is my next long-term partner till I die or something.
Exactly. Maybe what we want is just something that feels good with our bodies. Maybe what we want isn't even a sexual thing so much as a sensual thing. Mm. I want to be held. I want to feel skin on skin. I want to hear a voice laughing naked with me. You know, this is sex, but it's not intercourse.
Mm.
Maybe that's not what it's not true love.
Right.
So maybe what we have to do is be helped to question what we think we want next. And this helped me. I mean, as a sex educator, I was already a sex educator. I knew this stuff, but it was very hard to give it to myself. It was very hard to teach myself the lessons I already taught other people. It was like my uncle said, oh, I realized I didn't know a fucking thing.
Yeah, no, I totally relate. Yeah, there was that part where it was like, you know, you teach what you sort of need to learn yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
In that we know these things, but when we're going through it, it can be harder to apply what we know.
Right. So I had to keep asking myself, and I worked with grief counselors. I got a lot from grief counselors. And anyone who is a therapist now would learn a lot from the part of my book that's what I learned from my grief counselors.
Okay.
Because there are a lot of things in that chapter that you can help a client with without being a grief counselor yourself. But when I was trying to teach myself what to do next, I said, all right, when I was young, saying in my 30s and 40s, because in my 20s, I didn't know much. I explored, but I didn't know much. But in my 30s and 40s, I came into my own sexually. But I was a different person from the person that I was with Robert in my what I call wild child days. I had multiple partners. There were casual relationships. I felt if I had if a male friend was going to be a close friend, then obviously we needed to go to bed together too, that was part of becoming a close friend. Mm-hmm. And it didn't mean a committed relationship whatsoever. And I learned through that process in my 30s and 40s of being honest with my partners and saying, you know, this is what works for me now. And if it works for you, fantastic. If you're looking for something else, then it was probably not right for the two of us. Well, why couldn't I learn to do that again? Why couldn't I learn to do that at this stage of my life, having been in a committed monogamous relationship with Robert for 7 years, more because that was the kind of relationship that he needed in order to trust me. Mm. Whereas I was more expansive in the kinds of relationships that worked for me. But this was something, of course, I'm willing to do it because I'm in love with you and I'll do what it takes to be with you. And that was a decision I made. But coming out of that, I said, so what do I, what would work next? And I realized, well, in a way, it was going back to what I had known before Robert, being able to have a relationship that was respectful and loving without being committed. Mm. Someone that where there was affection there, there was, it wasn't a hookup kind of thing where I don't know him, I just want his body. I never felt that, but I did feel I want to experience the unpredictability about being touched by someone other than myself. Mm. That was what I was aiming for. But I wanted it to be with someone that I respected, who respected me, who I could be vulnerable with and I could be honest with and would tell me the truth too. If I said, this is what I think I need, but I don't really know totally because I haven't been able to try things very well. And I wanted someone who could say, yes, that works for me. And here's what I want in return. This is what I need. And we would agree on that. And I found, I don't know if you got to this chapter, that I was, after many fits and starts of things not working that I tried, I had a friends with benefits relationship with someone who had been a lover 15 years before.
Wow.
And this was someone who, for his own reasons, was looking for a non-committed relationship. And we talked and we met and we had a kiss to see if the chemistry was still there, and then said, let's try this. Let's see where it goes. And I understand it may not be full on everything. We may do some things. We may give each other pleasure without penetrative sex, or maybe it will get to that. And we have to decide that in advance, but we will decide that consensually as we work on what we want this relationship to be. I thought this would be something we'd do for a couple of months and sort of ease me into the next stage. But it turned out, I think it was probably a year or so. I may have recorded the exact time in the book, but I don't remember exactly. And then we sat down at one point and said, ready to move on now. He was, I was, we're still friends. So I'm not saying that is the way that any griever has to go, but we need to find our own way, what we need, what we want, and then try some things to get it and to be honest about it.
Yeah. And it sounds like, accept that it may look different, but also it can be different and that's okay. It's not,
yes.
We don't necessarily have to seek what we had before.
Right. Right.
What are some of the things that can happen to our sexuality and desire when we are grieving? Like, tell me what, like maybe physically, emotionally, that either you experienced or that in your research that you've discovered that like can be an experience of like grief. Like some people's bodies go numb or some people have heightened. Is that like, tell me about what can happen?
Yes, it's those two things and everything in between. So it can be going numb and not, it can be going numb physically or emotionally or both.
Okay.
It could be the body is alive, but the brain is saying, I don't want to let anyone in. So that's a good reason to buy some new sex toys, to explore sex with you. You don't need a partner to have orgasms or to have the sense of well-being that follows an orgasm or better sleep that follows an orgasm. You can be your own best lover for that time. So it may be that. It may be the body goes numb the brain is saying, yeah, I want sex, but I don't even feel anything. I don't feel anything. Get a stronger vibrator and work on relaxing your body, whether it's a hot bath, a massage, whatever will work to get yourself in a relaxed state. Leave all the devices somewhere else. Don't don't have the phone going off. Don't have the text pinging. Make time when you have just exercised, because that increases blood flow to all parts of your body, the muscles, the brain, and the genitals. Have your sex date with yourself before a meal, because a meal sends that blood flow to your digestive system. So in other words, we're working on what we can do to this body to make it most receptive to sexual pleasure. The exercise, the relaxation, not eating before sex, and then make plenty of time. And don't put goals on it. I'm going to see what gives me pleasure now. I'm not going to have a goal. If I don't have an orgasm, I failed. No, no, no. Just see what kind of touch can I respond to now? How can I bring my body to life without turning it off, without going so hard and goal-oriented that it responds by seizing up and saying, I will not listen to you. How can I coax sexual pleasure from it? So that's one way to deal with a numb body. A massage, a non-sexual massage, or an erotic massage, which I know those are not strictly legal, but you can find them. And I did that. It was wonderful. It was such a release to be able to put myself in the hands of someone who was skilled at massage and erotic massage, and where there was no expectation of reciprocity.
Love that.
That was important to me.
Totally.
Because I didn't, I thought, I don't know what that I have anything to give, and I don't want to have to give it.
Right. No energy just, to even think about it or anything like that.
Right. I just want to receive it. So the erotic massage was spectacular for me, and it opened me up to being able to see myself with a partner, at least a sex partner, not a love partner yet, but a sex partner. I wish this were more easily obtained, and I wish there wasn't that problem with the legality. But for any of you any of the audience who has contacts with erotic masseurs or masseuses, make that information available to your clients, please. You do them an honor by helping them to experience that. Now, there can be, I'm not ready yet, but I can see it happen. There's a glimmer. There's a little bit of, let's say that grief is a screen preventing me from touching or feeling or seeing what could be different. I can start to rip that screen a little bit, tear a little eye hole to be able to see what might be possible. There are some people, though, who have the absolute opposite experience. They want sex now. They are so, it's partly the nervous system, it's tension. I want that tension release of having someone give me an orgasm right now, right now. I don't care who it is. I want that now. And we need to be able to make that okay too. People are feeling and needing. We need to not judge whatever their path is. We can advise them how to do it safely. Okay, you want to go on Tinder and you want to just find someone for tonight, but you need to have the condoms, you need to have the dental dams, you need to have the lube, you need to have what you need, you need to, you know, let someone know who's coming over. All these things. I don't want to scare you, I just want to keep you safe. This is part of safer sex for you right now.
I thought it was interesting too. I think it was the part where the wrong things that people say. And there was one where someone was like, oh, like I'm craving having sex or like dating. And then people will sometimes say like, it's not the sex, you're just craving touch, like go get a hug or go do this. And
get your hair done.
Right. And some of them are like how craving and missing touch is more acceptable than craving sex or create like, and I think in the book, you're like, no, like it, you can miss sex. Like that's yes. Okay. That's totally, that is not, yes. That's not untrue. Like, yes, you could be missing touch, and also missing sex is totally reasonable and valid.
Absolutely.
And how one is considered more acceptable than the other, especially in grief or like when you're, if your partner has recently passed, of like, no, it's just touch you're missing. And it's like, no, I'm missing sex. It's okay.
One thing I advise therapists to do is to frame questions to coax out of a person what it is they really want. For example, not do you want sex? That's a yes or no, but rather, what are you doing with the sexual urges that arise? That is normalizing.
Yeah.
The sexual urges arise.
Yeah.
And all I'm asking is, what do you do about them? And then the next follow-up question is, what do you want to do about them? If you could do absolutely whatever you wanted with no repercussions, what would you do about your sexual urges?
Yeah, sort of framing it in a way that's, it's normal, it's expected.
Yes.
That you're experiencing these.
And another question could be, what kind of relationship might work for you when you're ready? Have you thought about that? Have you thought about how you might want to give and receive sexual pleasure when you're ready?
Do people ask, how do I know if I'm ready?
Or
how do I know if I'm ready?
Oh, yes. And the answer to that is, you don't. I wish I could say, yeah, here's the checklist.
Sure.
You probably don't. Maybe you do. If you think you're ready, maybe you're ready. If you think you might be ready, but you don't know, I'm more of a proactive try it and see person. I don't want to push someone into something they're not ready for. So I would say, well, what's a way you can go partway with this and see if you're ready? And maybe it's saying to someone that, let's say you've had some dates with this person, you feel turned on with this person, you have done the kissing part and it feels damn good. Am I ready to go to bed with this person? Well, maybe what you want to say is, I'm really attracted to you. I don't know if I'm ready. Can we agree on some pleasure we can give each other that would feel right to you, that would feel right to me, that wouldn't involve everything at once? And then we can check in about what we might want to do next time. You know, have this person be not an object that you're doing something to or asking to do to you, but that you are a consultant, a partner in planning to see what would work next. And you're going to encounter people that say, this is taking much too long, this is much too involved, I just want to go to bed with you. Are we doing this or not? And the answer is no, because I don't really feel I can bring my vulnerability into bed with us. Yeah. In a way, you are going to be three people, at least three people. There's going to be you. There's going to be the new partner. There's going to be the partner you lost. Who will be in your mind. You can't help it. There will be a touch that is not the same as your partner's touch. Can you respond to something different? Are you, as long, you know, this is again where therapy can help so much, is not to expect that you're going to duplicate what you had with your partner. that is a special place in your heart, in your memories, it's not going to happen again that way. But let's see, let's explore what your body, what your mind, what your heart can handle right now without anybody judging you.
Yeah, and it sounds like not expect to recreate the same thing that you had with another person, because you'll probably be let down if that's what we're expecting.
Well, you will have to be let down. Just in its simplest form, your late partner knew you, knew what you liked, knew your body inside and out, knew what your signals meant, knew what your sounds meant, what your squirms meant. A new person is going to go, okay, what do you I wonder what she likes.
I guess for people that are going through, that are grieving and have been in a long-term monogamous relationship, or even a long-term open relationship. And also if they are dating somebody who also was with long-term partners, you know, dynamics and peculiarities between people develop, right? So we also, also have to remember that they're bringing in a lot of past dynamic stuff that worked with that partner or those partners. And maybe we are, and we probably are too, right? So it's a matter of being open and curious and not kind of doing the old faithfuls that have developed between this one person and us, or our previous partners and us, right? Like experiment.
And communicate. Dan Savage, and I'm sure everyone has heard of Dan Savage, the sex columnist and podcaster, he says something that is so wise. He says, in gay land, when people give consent, that's the beginning of the conversation about what's going to happen. In straight land, when people give consent to have sex, there's this automatic default to penetrative sex, to penis and vagina, PIV. And saying yes to sex may be the end of the conversation. And he says, if people in straight land would do it the way people in gay land do, people would be having a lot more sex and enjoying it more.
Enjoy, yeah, and a lot more enjoyable sex, for sure.
And I think this is really wise, because it's that's often what stops grievers from going forward into a new sexual relationship, is the all or nothing attitude, that that's what's expected. And that saying, yes, I want to have sex with you, should only be the beginning. But let's talk about what we mean by that and what kind of sex we can have at this stage. At this stage. And someone who's not willing to take that journey with you is not the person you want at the beginning of that journey.
Yeah. And the communication too, and even speaking to like communication patterns, right? That can feel, if we've been communicating in these ways with previous partners, like we've also developed communication patterns, right? So it can be really daunting, confusing, concerning, exciting to after a partner has passed, just sort of be challenged to communicate in ways that maybe weren't happening, or with some with a new person about things that with this partner we maybe didn't talk about or didn't have to after so many years together. That's like that is really exciting and scary and activating, and is an opportunity to explore.
And if I can play the age card again,
please.
People at my age, or I mean, I'm about to turn 79, so that's really old, but people over 50, 60, 70 and beyond did not ever learn to ask for what they need for sexual pleasure. We never learned to do that. Sometimes we have to learn that now.
Absolutely. I mean, we're barely learning it now, you know?
I know.
So now, and I mean, I imagine, yes, that like, even, you know, the older you get, that the dialogue was even more disconnected.
That's right. And we feel we're going to break the mood, or we're going to offend the person, yes, or the person will say no to what we really want.
Or we're embarrassed.
Or we're embarrassed. That's all in us. We can overcome that all by ourselves. That isn't dependent on a partner's reaction to overcome it. We get to own this. And something that happened with my friends with benefits that was so important to me is I was, even with everything I know about sex and communication about sex, I was reluctant to say very directly what I needed. I was embarrassed about it. I didn't know how it would go over. And he said something so valuable to me. He said, "I love it when you give me directions because I really want to give you pleasure." Well, there it is. What was I holding back for? It helps him.
Absolutely.
If I give him instructions.
Yes, absolutely.
"I really like it when you do this and that, not so much. Would you switch to doing this?" And he would always say, "Thank you," anytime I did it. I would say, "A little bit to the right. Thank you."
That's really
cool. Oh my God. Yeah. Thank yes. you.
Yes. And it's so funny too. It's like, sometimes we just need an experience like that. You know, I'll share. I was always very concerned, which I think a lot of people sometimes struggle with, of like, I'm taking too long, particularly with oral sex, you know, when I'm receiving oral sex, of like, I'm taking too long, and it would impede on my ability to orgasm because I was worried about getting there and not being able to, and then worrying about time. And I one day, you know, despite being a sex and relationship therapist, I also struggle with those things as well, and an educator, and which is, I think it's important to speak about. And I articulated it one day, and my partner then would remind me in moments like, you know, "I could be here all day. You're not taking too long." And instantly I was relieved of it. Instantly, I was really, and it just took that moment, and it just took that moment of risk and chance, and sort of to sort of relearn that, to have this new reference point of like, oh, okay, so I just had to say it, and it's fine. And again, that's not the case all the time in every context, but sometimes it is, right? Sometimes it is the case.
I have a counterpoint to your story.
Yes.
Oh, you're gonna love this. Okay, so. When I was first with Robert, whom I met when I was 57, he was 64. And I had, you know, was obviously well past menopause, and the arousal was very slow. He, at that point, had not yet learned to accept using sex toys with me. So I was super slow. And I was embarrassed, just as you say. I was embarrassed about how long it was taking me, and that made it take longer. And finally, I blurted out to him, "Robert, I'm embarrassed because it's taking me so long, and I worry that you're going to get bored and want to give up." And he said, "I don't care if it takes 3 weeks, as long as I can take breaks sometimes to change positions and get something to eat."
And just knowing that, hearing that articulated.
Yeah.
Even if we, it does something. It does. It's so helpful. And breaking the silence, while really scary, is so, can be so empowering in those moments and in those ways. And I think, you know, I think in the beginning of the book, it talks about how, like, when I went researching, I found a culture of silence about sex and grief, and how that these desires and feelings that I was experiencing, particularly after, you know, a partner passing, were not discussed. And ultimately, then it makes us, it sort of has the same effect of making grieving harder. Because we feel like we're out here on by ourselves, and it's wrong to have these feelings, or like it feeds into that mentality of like, oh, it's wrong that I'm having these sexual urges, or it's wrong that I don't miss my partner more, quote unquote, which like, what does that mean? You know, so all of these expectations that really aren't true, but we've internalized.
That's right.
I want to talk about two more things. What do you think therapists often get wrong about grief and sex, or really either, particularly therapists who are not grief counselors? I mean, I wasn't trained in grief. I went to social work school and we weren't particularly trained in grief. I mean, and definitely not sex. But so what do you find that therapists and maybe mainstream culture get wrong about these things?
Good. Thank you for that. Well, one is something we talked about before, which is that no one timeline is right for everyone. We have this 1 year thing. And another that we've also talked about is that sex has to be all or nothing. We need to teach people to take sex in stages and make that okay. But another thing we haven't talked about is we tend to think, oh, the stages of grief, I know about them. But do you realize?
Yeah, that's the one thing I actually learned. I'm saying, not that I think about it. That was the one thing of like, oh, the stages of grief. There's five.
But it's faulty.
Yes.
Even Kubler-Ross herself said, I wish I hadn't called them stages because they're not linear. They are aspects of grief. We can't sit down with someone and say, well, it looks like you're done with denial. Are you feeling anger yet?
Right.
It does not make any sense. These aspects of grief are useful, but they are not stages. We can't put people in the formula where you're going to do this, and then that'll happen, and then that'll happen, and then finally you'll come to acceptance. Well, I can be in acceptance and go right straight to denial, or I can go, you know, they are not stages of grief. And so often we teach grievers this because it's something everybody knows. And we think, okay, I understand grief. Here's what I understand. Isn't that good? Aren't I helping you? You're not helping me right now. But we, as your clients, don't know enough to challenge you on that. We just think we are doing grief wrong. Wait, I never felt anger. I'm supposed to feel anger? But what did he do wrong? He died. That's not his fault.
What stage am I in?
Yeah, what stage am I in, and how much longer is this going to take? Totally. So it just sets us up for feeling bad about ourselves no matter where we are. Instead of that, if we help people understand that this is cyclical, it's like, I don't know, it's not even a circle cycle, but it's sort of a spiral circle where there's a little bit of this and then it goes up here and then it comes down and sinks down for a while. It plays around under sea level for a while and pops up again. I could see, it would be very interesting to see an artist's visualization of what the grief cycle is like. But it's enough to know it's not linear, it's not predictable, and there's no one way to do grief right. The way to do grief right is to really feel it, not to white knuckle it, not to say, well, I can't make another appointment about this. We've already talked about it 20 times. I'm a failure if I'm still not done with it, if I still don't understand where I am or what to do. We need to invite people in it wherever they are and be patient. And also to admit that until we've been through it, we really don't understand it. We can say, I know this, but the best grief counselors are the ones that have been through it.
Yeah. What is feeling it look like it, because sometimes I feel that we talk about these things when we're like, you know, feel your emotions and like move with it and through it, and But what does feeling grief mean? What does it look like? How do we do it?
One of my grief counselors had a wonderful analogy that worked so well for me. He said, there's the grief train. You're on the grief train. You can get off the grief train at certain stops and wait a while, but the only way you're going to arrive at your destination of fully dealing with it and being able to move on is if you stay on the grief train until you reach the destination. You can get off, but that's just giving you a break. You can't stay off. There's no place to go. Yeah. You have to get back on. And when you're on the grief train, there are two cars on the grief train. There's the grief car and there's the work car. The grief car is when it is your emotions are uncontrollable. You can't fix them. All you can do is feel them. You're still getting to your destination. The train is moving. It doesn't feel like it because you're on the grief car and that doesn't change for now. The other car, the one you can sometimes go into when you're ready, when you have, when you're in the space to do that, is the work car. And that's where you do the work with a therapist or on your own. You write in your journal. You figure things out. You look forward. You say, when I get it to my destination, here's what I hope I'll find. Here's what I'm going to look. Here's the kind of place I'll try to rent in this new destination and the people I'll want to inhabit it with me. So I found that the best explanation of grief. Does it make sense to you not having gone through it?
That analogy?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does make sense. It does make sense. And really it's comical, but not in that a lot of times with grief and unrelated to grief, with a lot of these things, it's almost the same analogy, right? It's like we sitting with it and being with it and experiencing it looks all types of ways, and mm-hmm. also that it has to be done at some point, and it's going to look all different, all types of ways, but that we do it, and and that there is no answer sort of thing. There is no precise moment of you're through it or you are ready and it's done. It's a clean closure. And that's part of the human experience. And that's what's really difficult. And I agree with you. I think there are things that having not experienced it, we can intellectually know, mm-hmm. but that's very different than feeling it and having experienced it and gone through it, which can be very moving and healing to experience and like articulate to others.
Yeah. And I don't in any way want to say that people listening to this podcast will think, well, I can't counsel anyone who's been through grief, then I have to refer out. Well, no, you can to a certain extent, but also be aware at what point you might need to refer out.
Absolutely. Joan, where can we find you, find your book, your contact you? Where can we find you?
You can find everything at joanprice.com. Joan Price as in price tag.com. You'll see all my books. You'll see my blog. One of the things I do is review sex toys from a senior perspective.
Oh, love it. Love
tough
that.
Job, but someone's got to do it.
Someone has to.
I put out a newsletter about monthly of the news and views that have happened in the last month. It's regarding senior sex more than sex after grief, but it includes both and people can sign up for that. So joanprice.com has everything, including how to contact me. I have some webinars available. A lot of tips, a lot of free tips and some paid things. And I love giving presentations to therapists. I've done this quite a bit in the last year And especially lately, it seems I'm being asked to do that quite a bit. Sometimes a medical office or a therapist's office where there are a number of people who work together and hire me to come in and talk to them about either sex and aging or sex and grief. And I hope more of you will contact me about that, because I love to share what I know, and the end result, of course, is to help the people who need it.
Sure. I know this is my last actual question, but as someone who's written a bunch of books, I'm always so impressed by that. What's your strategy? And not even necessarily in terms of sales, but like, do you wake up and write for an hour a day? Like, how do you, as someone who writes as much as you do for a living, how do you do it? What is your tip? Do you have a hot tip?
I could be really simplistic and say I do it one word at a time, but
every writer says that. They're like, you have to write, and it's like,
Well, I do have some tips about writing, and it isn't when I'm working on a book, which I am not right now. When I'm working on a book, I just have to say, this is my day job and I'm going to do this. Mm. But one thing that makes it easier is at the end of the workday, leave in the middle of something, not at the end of something. If you go, okay, I'm on a roll, I can finish this chapter right now, stop. I'll take this up tomorrow, because it is much easier to start writing at the beginning of the day when you left something in the middle, when you know where you're going.
Mm. It so is you, really if you hard. Know that you, if you know you have to finish this part.
Right. And I know it's going to be in it because I almost wrote it last night and I stopped myself. Mm. So I could be working on a chapter and then think, okay, I've had it. I want to go for a walk. So I'm just going to make a few notes about where I'm going with this next time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, done, put it away. And then the next day when I go, oh, I don't know where to start. Oh yes, I do. I left it with guidance of where to start. So that's helpful. The other thing is to always keep in mind the person who needs this information. I'm not writing because I want to have a book out. I'm writing because there are people who need this information that I have. Mm. And so I have the honor of providing it, and I'm going to do it in the best way I can. And I'm going to ask myself all the way through, is this clear enough? Is this actionable? Because people want that.
Yeah.
They don't just want concepts. They want to, well, what does this mean to me?
Yeah. How do I apply it?
You know, you can be explaining spontaneous versus responsive desire to someone, but until you say, so here's how you can put it into action, then it's not going to sink in or be helpful.
Joan, thank you so much. This was so wonderful. I am so happy that we were able to set this up, and I've learned so much, and I recommend your book, Sex After Grief, and the several of your books that I've read. I haven't read them all, to therapists, to sex educators, because they do hit on topics that, I definitely didn't get it when I was going to school to be a therapist, but even beyond that. So I so appreciate you coming on. This was amazing.
You can find Joan and her books and the webinars and her blog at joanprice.com, J-O-A-N, price, like price tag, .com. The Naked at Our Age with Joan Price Facebook page is search Joan Price Author on Facebook. Twitter at Joan Price. Joan is on LinkedIn. And on Instagram at the Joan Price. You can find me, your host, Sarah Kelleher, at Psych and the City BK on Instagram. I am on Twitter, Psych ND the City on Twitter. And I also made a website for the podcast, psychandthecitybk.com. You can find all the episodes there, in addition to more stuff about the show, and I'll be adding more to that. And you can also contact me if you know of someone who wants to be on the show, you have thoughts about the show, or you just like to talk. So thanks for listening.